Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Fort Lauderdale voters will go to the polls March 13th and pick a new mayor. They have two candidates to choose from. They are both current commissioners. Now, we're going to hear first from Commissioner Bruce Roberts. He's the former chief of police and currently the vice mayor. He's commissioner for District 1. We will hear from Commissioner Dean Trantalis afterward. That interview was pre-taped. Mr. Roberts, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. So this is a runoff election. So you're basically reintroducing yourself to the voters. So real briefly, what should they know about you?
Well, I think most do know. As you indicated, I was your police chief in Fort Lauderdale for 6.5 years, served on our department for a total of 35 years, and have been on the city commission for 9 years, representing the district, the north part of the city right now. And that's a total of 44 years of public service to Fort Lauderdale. I grew up in Fort Lauderdale, went to high school in Fort Lauderdale, raised my family in Fort Lauderdale. My whole life is Fort Lauderdale. I love the great city of Fort Lauderdale.
How do you run differently this time in this runoff election? Is the campaigning going to be different?
I think the campaigning is focusing on the issues that we have to face, and I think we're both focused on those. I think we have a different approach as to how we solve those particular problems.
So name one or two of the big issues or the big things that you as mayor are going to tackle.
Well, I'll always be a priority with public safety. Whatever we do in the community, if you don't have public safety, the community is not a stable community. You can't have enjoyment, quality of life. You can't have economic development. You can't have kids going to school safely. You can't have the tourists coming to the city of Fort Lauderdale. So it's always going to be about public safety. That's kind of an underlying basis for what we have to do. And sometimes in campaigns, we tend to lose focus on that, but that's always going to be a top priority with me. And the other priority is our infrastructure and how we go forward with dealing in our infrastructure. And it's no secret, Fort Lauderdale, like many cities across the country and even in our region, have infrastructure problems which need to be dealt with.
All right. You talk about infrastructure. So listen, we're going to go through some of these big issues here. Let's start with that one, because one of the big stories recently was the issue with sewage. The sewage problems alone have gotten just a lot of attention statewide even. What do you think about the problem and this new $200 million bond that may not help?
It definitely will help. But let me go back a little bit as we talk about our infrastructure problems. Back in March of this past year, our staff had identified about 13 top priority projects which needed to be dealt with. And we weren't getting the job done, quite frankly. So in the end of August, when we were having a meeting with our budget task force, infrastructure task force, two different independent boards, advisory boards for the city of Fort Lauderdale, I put staff, including the city manager, on notice that we had to get these projects out to Gore. They were funded. So they weren't getting accomplished. So they've developed what a program called Go Big, Go Fast. And by the end of August, we started on the program dealing with one of our main sewer lines that caused a lot of news, unfortunately, because of the break it had in our Tarpon River neighborhood in particular. That particular line went on back on full operations back in December of this past year. That line handles 30% of the sewage of the city of Fort Lauderdale. So I think we're going in the right direction, providing additional funding. And that $200 million bond issue, which we approved at our last commission meeting, is meant to help address the other top priorities and fund those, get those done over the course of the next 2 to 3 years. And bear in mind, we have to develop a 20-year program. You'll hear a lot about the $1.4 billion in infrastructure that's needed. That's a 20-year program that we need to move forward on. So this $200 million is meant to deal with the top priorities and the immediate causes over the next 2 to 3 years.
All right. We talk about other infrastructure issues. Of course, we talk about sea level rise. We see that issue every time a king tide rolls in. South Florida, just South Florida in general, really almost ground zero for this issue in the entire country. But how is the city of Fort Lauderdale approaching this issue? And what are you telling people when they're talking about water coming up in places they didn't expect to see it?
Well, you're right. It's a regional issue in Fort Lauderdale and Miami Beach in that area. And we're part of the South Florida Consortium. There's four counties that belong to that, Monroe, Miami-Dade, Broward, and West Palm Beach. And when you go around the country and you see what's going on, it's not just South Florida, although we are at ground zero, as you indicated. There's other parts of the country that have issues with the sea level rise. We had the great storm that occurred just this past winter in Boston Harbor. In Boston Harbor, the seawalls were breached because of the storm, and they had flooding in the Boston area, too. So in addition to becoming a participant with the South Florida Consortium and developing a regional approach to the sea level rise, we're also part of, I think, Congressman Ted Deutsch and I can't recall the congressman from Miami-Dade County, who is the Republican. They formed a bipartisan committee to deal with sea level rise and infrastructure issues. And that's a 48-member committee. That committee has, you can't belong to that unless you have, bring somebody from the other party with you. And why I bring that up is because I was part of a Chamber of Commerce fly into D.C. after Hurricane Irma, and what I was assigned to was a task force with other members of that fly-in to visit other congressional leaders throughout the country. Boston Harbor was one of them, a woman that represents the Illinois River in central Illinois, a congressman from Texas, a congressman from the Sacramento River Valley in California. And the purpose of that was to try to bring other people on board to join this group, a committee, if you will, to develop a national approach to sea level rise. And every area of the country has different methodologies which will have to be developed to address that particular issue. So it's a national approach for the funding dollars, partnering with education and universities to develop the technologies to deal with it, and also the local regions down here in South Florida.
And the congressman you're talking about is Republican Carlos Curbelo.
Thank you very much, yes.
You know what, and again, just jumping through these different topics, let's talk about development. This one, too, was one brought up. Along with most of the other commissioners, you voted to approve the Bahia Mar development. I'm hoping I'm saying that right.
That is correct.
Your opponent voted against it. Why'd you vote for it?
Well, I voted for it for several reasons. I thought, number one, we had legal restrictions on what we could or could not do with the current lease that was signed in 1995 that we're operating under. And our city attorney also put us on notice through a memorandum, which was part of the public hearing, which somehow got bypassed by a lot of individuals. But she said that we had limited flexibility in denying this project going forward because it was being built according to the zoning and to the code, the latest rendition that came out. So that was one aspect of it. And we had a history in the past in dealing with a project by a related group on Las Olas. It's called the Icon. It was next to a historic building called the Stranahan House. And the city and the Historical Society entered into a lawsuit to try to prevent that building being put up. The lawsuits were lost, and consequently, the building is up there. I didn't want to put us in a financial liability of a losing lawsuit. But in addition to that, on the economic side of it, we have now the boat show was helped develop that site plan. And Fort Lauderdale International Boat Show is now here for 30 years as a result of that development of the site plan. A huge economic impact, $857 million for a year for the boat show in the city of Fort Lauderdale. That's bigger than two Super Bowls coming to the area.
I want to get your take. As you said, I mean, you're a Fort Lauderdale guy. You've been here a very long time. So you've seen the growth. You've seen the region grow. And it's a region that still continues to grow, which means growing pains. Just your overall take on growth in your region, in your area, but in the city. Are you doing it the right way, or do you have to kind of direct that development to make sure, because then you're going to deal with, the sewage problem you have to deal with, the rising seas, traffic congestion. We haven't even got to that yet.
No, you're absolutely right. It has to be a strategic growth, if you will. And the strategic growth is important, like in the downtown area, the urban corridor we have developed there. I think that's downtown. That's the way it should be in the downtown area. In fact, that was set in motion back in the late 1980s by former commissioner developing a regional activity center. So that growth is finally coming to fruition. And I look at it as an economic development engine, too. Don't forget, in Fort Lauderdale, our unemployment rate is down at 3.4%. We're competitive in different industries. We're diversifying our tourism industry, our marine industry. We're bringing in industries related to technology, to education, and to pharmaceuticals. And you have to be a dynamic and vital city to compete with that and also provide quality of life. And to that end, while we're growing in one aspect we're talking about, we do need to preserve the quality of life for our citizens. Since I've been on the commission the past 9 years, we have opened 17 new parks in the city of Fort Lauderdale and refurbished 25. And that's just one indicator as we go towards maintaining the quality of life, but also being active and dynamic in the 21st century.
Again, I'm talking with Commissioner Bruce Roberts. He's Commissioner for District 1 in Fort Lauderdale. He is one of two candidates running for mayor. That election coming up again, the runoff election, coming up March 13th. Let's move over to the issue of immigration. And you, former chief of police, what role, if any, does Fort Lauderdale Police play in regards to federal immigration laws?
We do not participate in enforcing federal immigration laws. That's not our responsibility. Our responsibility is to maintain the peace and tranquility and quality of life within the city of Fort Lauderdale and enforcing our ordinances and state statutes. Will we assist other agencies if asked to? Of course we will, whether there's other state agencies, or whether they're county agencies, or other federal agencies.
And, you know, of course, one of the other big stories recently was border customs and border protection boarding on a Greyhound bus and removing a person from that bus. And this is not new, and we've talked about it on the show, you know, where customs agents go to find people. But, I mean, your take on this issue, because obviously a lot of attention is now going to come on to Fort Lauderdale.
Well, my take is we have, as I tried to indicate before, we have our own issues to deal with, and that those issues belong to the federal agencies and the federal government, and they need to be dealt with. And any approval or disapproval by our neighbors in the city of Fort Lauderdale need to be directed in that area.
As chief of police, you obviously saw, you know, the drug issues in South Florida right now, dealing with the opioid addiction problem in South Florida, up and down from Palm Beach County down through Miami. How big of an issue is that in Fort Lauderdale
right
now?
It's a huge issue. It is. It's just like most municipalities and areas across the country. But we recently joined in the national lawsuit, with hiring a law firm to go after the distributors and the companies that are overstocking what's necessary in the area. And we work with our police and our fire department and other local agencies to address those issues, and getting what we need is more of a treatment facilities. We need more education out there to be able to try to stem the tide. We were successful in the past, don't forget, in closing down the pill mills in Broward County, and then we had a Flocka epidemic too in the city of Fort Lauderdale and Broward County. Those were eliminated. So I look to take those same tactics and strategies that we use in overcoming that terrible destruction of people with this opioid crisis too.
Can you elaborate a little bit about what you learned from, again, shutting down the pill mills and dealing with the Flocka problem, and how you're going to bring those tactics to dealing with this issue, which is still growing?
It is multifaceted. So it's obviously the law enforcement side of things has to be constant and very aggressive. Education, starting with our youth, education all through the schools and the high schools, partnering with the Broward County school system, which we did in the past, working with the medical field and working with our state legislators and also our federal legislators to really develop laws that are based on the U.S. Surgeon General's guidelines that were established on opioid prescriptions and medication probably about 3 or 4 years ago. And I think that's a template for us to use statewide, and then drain it down towards the local municipalities to deal with that.
Let's talk about homelessness, the homeless issue. Fort Lauderdale just had some bad luck these last couple of years, in that you had a couple of events that pretty much gave the city a black eye on a national level. You obviously had the issue earlier last year with homeless in Stranahan Park, and that's when a bulldozer came through and started to remove a lot of trash, but a lot of stuff that belonged to some of these homeless people. And then you had the Arnold Abbott issue. This was a gentleman who was feeding homeless people. And again, both of these issues hit the national news, became the butt of jokes on late night shows. I mean, so how is the city handling this? How do you clean up that issue and fix the problem?
Well, you know, in my career in law enforcement, we had actually two other issues back in the 90s. We actually had a homeless encampment by Holiday Park, and then another one that got moved downtown by the old heliport, which is right across from City Hall. And now we're dealing with a similar situation down by the library in downtown, as you indicated. So on the positive side of things, working with Hope South Florida and our faith-based organizations and other private sector advocates, we pretty much eliminated the veteran homeless issue in Fort Lauderdale, Broward County area, and we have available the services to take care of families. So we're dealing with a hardcore group of 387, the last count, of chronic homeless who often don't want to help and prefer to stay on the street. So we need to keep chipping away at those numbers. We also have a Fort Lauderdale homeless outreach team, two officers. They make 13,000 contacts a year, a lot of that repetitive with the homeless community, to try to help get them the assistance they need and get them off the street. So what I would like to do is we continue those positive initiatives that have been working, and also get together with Broward County, because Broward County is a big partner in dealing with this issue. And I will meet with the Broward County quarterly, and homelessness will be one of the top priorities that we deal with in those types of workshops. For example, we also want to reopen the unused stockade on Paroline Road in Fort Lauderdale and repurpose that for a processing and a homeless assistance center to get the people off the street, to feed them so they can take showers, and then maybe get them into the Housing First programs that are available to them also.
And that was discussed once before, and there was some controversy with that. But you know, as a law enforcement officer, so there the statistics and numbers in reducing homelessness or helping deal with the problem, and then there's the, again, what people think of Fort Lauderdale. And so it's almost like you have to have a marketing campaign, or you have to have a marketing idea. to, again, fix the reputation, because the reputation of the city has been marred by this.
I agree with you, and that's why I'm saying that. I'm going to go to work on that, work with Broward County, and you're right. We need a marketing campaign. In fact, I've been an advocate of that with the city manager to get that going on how we deal with that so we don't leave with our chin, so to speak, in dealing with this particular issue.
Let's talk about transportation, traffic, commutes, and, of course, you know, all that traffic out there. One of the big controversies, too, recently was the WAVE streetcars. Just an overall picture of what you think about, again, as the city grows, the economy is good. That means more people are going to be out there. The commute gets harder. What's the solution to that? Do we have to get more people into public transit, or is it just make the roads bigger, or what do we do?
Well, we can't make the roads bigger. I sit on the MPO, Metropolitan Planning Organization, which directs traffic dollars. As a matter of fact, to build a road, acquire a right-of-way, and go 1 mile in each direction is about $100 million. That's not going to happen. So we need to develop other methodologies. What they are exactly, I do not know, but they need to be modern transportation. As the new technologies become available to us, get those people into that type of new transportation and move people through our community. I have to say, you touched on it too, over 200,000 people a day are coming into Fort Lauderdale, leaving Fort Lauderdale, or commuting within the city just to go to work. Then you throw in the fact we have 16 million tourists to come to the area. Then you throw into the fact that in Broward County, we are the cultural and the social activity center for the county with the Performing Arts Center, with the Science Center, the special activities that take place on the beach, like the Swatch Volleyball Match, the Tortuga Fest. All these types of things add that vitality and dynamic life to the city of Fort Lauderdale. But the negative side of that is the traffic.
Let's finish up with this. Again, kind of just letting the voters know who you are. But what's different about you than your opponent?
I'm a leader. I'm a person of action. I don't believe in finger-pointing. I believe that we need to address the issues head-on that we deal with. But also, let's cherish the beauty of the city of Fort Lauderdale and what a great place it is to live and how dynamic it is. We call ourselves a neighborhood of neighborhoods, and I think that points to our diversity and to our unity at the same time. We all want that same quality of life, which we're all striving for. Every neighborhood wants that same quality of life. And that's our job as a politician or a leader, is to be able to deliver that, not complain about it, but to deliver that through action steps. And I think I showed some of those action steps here today in talking about the need to maintain public safety and also the action steps directly related to infrastructure.
He is the vice mayor and commissioner of District 1, Bruce Roberts. He's one of the two candidates for the mayor of Fort Lauderdale. Again, that election is coming up March 13th. Bruce Roberts, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, still to come, we're going to hear from the other Fort Lauderdale mayoral candidate, Dean Trantalis. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. All right, so we just heard from Fort Lauderdale Commissioner and Vice Mayor Bruce Roberts. Now let's listen to a conversation that we recorded yesterday with Fort Lauderdale Commissioner Dean Trantalis. Again, he's in a runoff election with Roberts for the mayor's office, and that election is March 13th. We started by asking him how he would introduce himself to voters.
Dean Trantalis, city commissioner for almost 8 years, and an activist, community organizer, someone who likes to step out, be with people, listen to people, be the people's mayor, someone who will be there for the folks that have been looking for answers and relief from so much that goes on in our community. We have a great deal of positive energy that's going on in our city, a lot of investment opportunity, of young folks looking for career opportunities to come to Fort Lauderdale. So the mayor and the commission and the city manager have to be the ones to work together in order to fashion the best possible approach to making Fort Lauderdale the best city in Florida.
Let's talk about the issues. We're going to hit each one here as we go. Infrastructure, this is a big one. And we talked about the issue that's erupted recently.
Literally.
The sewage problems. Explain what's been happening and how you think the city should be dealing with this problem.
Unfortunately, the city has been dealing with it in a very helter-skelter kind of way over the last decade. First of all, the management of the city has been siphoning off funds that were intended for the rehabilitation of our water treatment plants, for the reconstruction of our underwater systems, and has been using it just to pay bills. including, you know, we have very big pension obligations now. We have just a lot of bills that have surfaced. And unless we took money away from the water and sewer fund, our city budget would never have been balanced. So we've created this problem. It's an artificial problem. We knew it was coming. The systems are old within our city, and we ignored what was happening. So when we say there's an infrastructure problem, yes, we have a problem, but we also have an answer. And the way to respond to it is with a comprehensive approach. Right now, we're just doing it piecemeal. We're able to understand that I think it was $200 million that the water rates would allow us to borrow, and that those water rates would be sufficient to pay for a $200 million bond.
The $200 million bond, is that enough?
Of course not. And not only is it not enough, but it doesn't really have to be spent in the first year. That's over a several-year period. And my concern and my protest was that we were looking to borrow money today and yet would not use it for several years from now. So we're spending interest and paying interest on money we're not even using yet. So I just thought that the whole approach to this has become a little amateurish, and I thought that we could do a better job. Now, $200 million, where is it going? There's a laundry list of things that we need to do. We're playing catch-up because the state is breathing down our neck with a consent order. Get these things done by June of this year or else. No other city suffers from that indignation. And the people of this community have, you know, they pay a lot of money in taxes, and they pay a lot of money in water, and they pay a lot of money in sewer. And all they do is they see seepage in their streets and down their rivers. We did an analysis. When I say we, the city and the county, did an analysis of the water content in some of the waterways in and around the Las Olas Isles. And I cannot tell you how putrid these waterways are. I went on an art tour this past weekend where you take a boat and visit various houses in Fort Lauderdale to see artwork. It was a fundraiser. It was a charity event. And I couldn't believe how dark and brown and how disgusting the water was. And we just ignore what's in our backyard. And so we can do a better job.
All right. The city is home to a very vibrant LGBTQ community, one of the most important in the country. Do you think that everyone's needs are being met?
The gay and lesbian community is a very important part of the Fort Lauderdale population, and it has grown over the years. Statistically, it's one of the highest number of same-sex households in the country per capita. And I'm proud to be a part of that community and have been here for almost 36 years watching it grow and prosper and helping Fort Lauderdale grow and prosper. The needs of our community are best met by people being able to live, work, go to public places without interference of discrimination. At the county level, I have worked with others to try to ensure that the laws are there to help those who will not be discriminated against based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. And that's been an important part of my history. And I think those fights, though, continue as we try to seek equality in all measures, because discrimination always seems to find a way to rear its ugly head, and people like myself and our allies should work together to ensure that this doesn't continue in our own city.
And if elected, you would be the city's first openly gay mayor.
I would be the city's first openly gay mayor.
What personal insights do you have then you could bring to the job to help in dealing with any problems that, as you just mentioned, some of the things that you need to bring to help and protect this community?
I think that being a member of the gay community is important, as any member of any minority is important, because each minority, whether you're gay, whether you're African American or from the Caribbean, whether you're Muslim, Jewish, we all seem to find ourselves in growing up and building our careers in a way that we feel almost like we're outsiders. and we tend to huddle together and form our own groups. And I want to do my best to integrate all the folks that live in our community, and so that we can work together, play together, you know, have fun together and prosper together. So I understand the importance of being in a minority, and I understand the significance of discrimination. And those are the things that I want to bring to my city to try to combat, so that no one, no neighborhood is left out. So the folks that live on the other side of the tracks can hold hands with those that live across the tracks, and we can work together to make that happen.
Let's talk about another vulnerable population, immigrants. And, of course, we've had this story recently. It's been in the news a lot, this conversation about Border Patrol agents removing people from Greyhound buses in Fort Lauderdale. Customs and Border Protection say that's their right within 100 miles of a U.S. border. But what do you think about this situation and what's happened?
It's a disgrace. There's no country in this world that should be going bed checking to see if you've got papers to allow you to stay in this country. This country is a country that is always has embraced the people from other parts of the world who have who have suffered the threats of life, certainly economic disadvantages. But more importantly, if we look to the conditions that other people suffer in this world, and we look to the wealth that we have in this country, there's got to be a way to systematically share in what we can produce. For example, my grandparents were immigrants, and my story is like the story of many, many other people who now are professionals in this world. And we look back to the conditions that they suffered when they came to this country, but they worked hard, and they were the only ones that would work hard. They're the ones that take on the jobs that perhaps many Americans won't take on. So this country thrives on immigrant labor and immigrant interests. You know, immigrants tend to be the most nationalistic people and patriotic people in this country. Now, I'm not saying Americans aren't patriotic, but you speak to immigrants, and the vitality of their patriotism is palpable. It makes you feel good as an American to know that others appreciate what we in generations have been able to build in this country, and that they want to be part of that. They're not looking to destroy it. They're not looking to commit crimes. They're looking to just provide food on the table for their family like anybody else.
Let's move to another population that's vulnerable, the homeless. This is another big issue in Fort Lauderdale. Back in May, the city took a black eye when a bulldozer came through parts of Stranahan Park, pushed out the homeless people. You go back a couple of years to what happened to Arnold Abbott. This is a man who was feeding the homeless. He was arrested numerous times. Both of these stories put Fort Lauderdale on the national map and the butt of jokes on late night shows. I mean, what's the homeless issue in Fort Lauderdale? How is the city dealing with this?
Unfortunately, the city is not dealing with it. And the way they deal with it is the wrong way. So Arnold Abbott, black eye number one, bulldozers, black eye number two. So now we have two black eyes, and we have still not healed from them. Arnold Abbott still has charges pending against him, and the encampment by the county library just went back to where it was. So the bulldozer attempt meant nothing. Okay, so I sit on the Broward County board, continuum of care board for the homeless. I've sat on that board for the last 3 years. I've become extremely aware and sensitive to the needs and the laws and the opportunities that we have as a city to draw on. But the only money that we spend for the most part in our community is money that we get through grants. We don't use municipal funds in any large measure to work with the homeless. The homeless they come from different worlds, and each and homeless people are not to be grouped as one. Everyone has their own reason for being homeless. It could be economic reversal. It could be addiction issues. It could be psychiatric issues. There are lots of different reasons why people are homeless. We have veteran homeless. And we have a lot of resources committed in our community to veteran homelessness. Veteran homelessness is calculated at being between 7% and 9% of the total population. So we have Operation Lift Hope, which was created. We have United Way. All these resources are really doing a very good job at trying to sift out the veterans from the homeless population and give them a leg up on trying to try to get themselves back on their feet. The other 93% is a problem that we have failed to address. I have been working with nonprofits and community leaders over the last year, and God willing, should I become mayor, we're going to try to establish a comprehensive program to try to work with the homeless and take them out of our parks, take them off our streets. They don't want to be there themselves. They have no other place to go. So let's work with them. The parks are very important, especially in neighborhoods, because many people and children, families feel threatened by the presence of homeless people. Some homeless people, unfortunately, are disrespectful of the property and the areas in which they inhabit. I'm sorry to see that, but the point is that we need to make sure that's not their permanent home. They need to be taken away from those areas.
And then you have, again, a person like Arnold Abbott, who was he's still facing legal challenges. And again, he was basically fighting with the city because he wanted to feed the homeless, but there was a fight as to where he could feed them.
Well, he had a feeding program once a week. I believe it was Wednesday on the beach, Fort Lauderdale Beach. He wasn't bothering anybody. In fact, tourists would come by and they would help on the feeding line. And it was a statement more than anything being made by Mr. Abbott that the world needs to help those who can't help themselves. He not only fed the homeless, he also taught cooking. He also taught preparation of food. I've met Arnold many, many times. He's really getting on in years and he's becoming more and more weak. And he's, I believe, he's 92 now. And instead of working with Mr. Abbott, we tried to bump heads with him. And I remember the day after he was first arrested, we got over 5,000 emails from around the world castigating us as to how awful we were as a community. I don't think we've ever gotten over that. Okay, and we need to find ways to work with the homeless and with the business community so that the business community and the residential community that seems to border the homeless encampments can together make sure that we can achieve a successful resolution here. In fact, the very first, God willing, should I become mayor, the very first month that I sit in that seat, I intend to initiate a program that hopefully by year's end, we will not see homeless on the streets.
You know what? One of the big controversies right now, part of a very heated debate in Fort Lauderdale is the WAVE streetcars, but real briefly, talk about this debate and just, again, traffic issues like anything else here in South Florida. I mean, how are you tackling it?
Well, one of the important things about traffic is that, people still, this is still a car-oriented society. While it's important that we improve alternative methods of transportation, such as the use of bikes and the creation of bike lanes throughout the city, we are still car-oriented. Emergency vehicles are still operated through regular cars and trucks, so we cannot impede their operation because of development. So we need to be smart about this. We talk about smart growth. Well, smart growth means making sure that we don't compromise the quality of life we've already created here in Fort Lauderdale with new development. I believe there's a way to do it, and I know we're going to be able to be successful in the years ahead. The WAVE was intended to be as an alternative form of transportation. But when we got down into the nitty-gritty of looking at its vital components, we saw that it really didn't make any sense for Fort Lauderdale. At least I don't believe it does. It's taking a 19th century form of technology and trying to apply it to the 21st century. It was sort of a throwback to a nostalgic time in which people went around in these streetcars and there were rails and there were overhead wires and people could hop on and hop off, and that was going to bring charm to the downtown. Well, we don't need that now. We have charm. We have exciting things going on in our downtown. We have open-air theaters and art walks. We have a tremendous amount of vitality that is taking place, and the WAVE is just going to interfere with that. It's going to take up a lane of traffic. It's going to cost millions of dollars a year to operate. The people of Fort Lauderdale are going to foot that bill every single year, and we have other things that are more important than that.
Let's finish with this. Again, talking to the voters, what would you say is different about you than your opponent, who, by the way, is also a city commissioner?
I think that I come to this position, seeking out the position of mayor, with a greater sense of vision and where we're going to go. I'm the person that is going to approach this with a sense of a holistic approach to how we're going to maintain the quality of life in our community and still allow there to be growth and invite people from other parts of the country and the world to share in that quality of life. We continue to run roughshod over that quality of life with the decisions that have been made by this commission year after year. It's been extremely frustrating for me to be the one vote out of five time and time again. I try to be a player. I try to be a part of the group. But there comes a point in time where your priorities have to be established to know that you're doing the right thing. Taking money out of the water and sewer fund every single year, especially this last year when we were in a crisis, and yet my opponent still voted to take money out of the water and sewer fund. That's just another example. The Bahia Mar on the beach, public land, again, just completely ignoring what the community wanted and voting to build 651 rental units in one of the most compromised areas in the entire city, where the environment is so fragile, where reports have said don't build anything else on the beach, where roads are already graded D and F. What other message did you need to know that we should never have voted for that proposal? Yet my opponent voted for that. These are the types of things that differentiate us, and I think that the voters understand that the vision that I bring to this position as mayor is the one that most of us are seeking.
Dean Trentalis, he is one of the two candidates running for mayor in Fort Lauderdale. Mr. Trentalis, thank you so much for the
time. Thank you for having me.
Yep, again, that was Fort Lauderdale Commissioner of District 2, Dean Trentalis. You can find us on Facebook, look up WLRN Sundial. Let us know what you think about the two candidates and what are some of the other important issues in Fort Lauderdale that you want them to tackle. Well, still to come, when's the last time you looked at a map? And I'm not talking about on your phone. I'm talking about a real fold-out map. Well, the International Map Fair is coming to Miami, and we have a treat for you. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. You know, there was a time when you would plan a trip or you'd head out on the road and, well, you had to stop and take a look at a map. There was no Siri, please pull up a map. There was no Waze. It was either Rand McNally map or the AAA map, and you had to open it up and scour through all those multicolored lines to figure out where you were going. And then, of course, you had to figure out the distance, right? The miles, kilometer scale. And you probably used, the tip of your index finger or pen cap to try to measure out how far you had to go. Well, the Miami International Map Fair is this weekend. It is celebrating its 25th anniversary. Now, they're not going to have those maps. They're going to have really cool maps. And I could say this because I've been there to the fair, and they have some amazing maps dating back hundreds of years. Beautiful, beautiful works of art, really, when you think about it, and a lot of wonderful history. One of the collectors is going to be there is Barry Lawrence Rudderman, who is displaying a very rare, special map. And just talk about maps altogether. He's joining me now in studio. Barry, such a pleasure to have you.
It's great being here. Thank you.
Yeah, you know what? You were a lawyer first, right?
Correct.
And then you got into maps. What was the moment when all of a sudden you realized maps are your world?
Well, that's a great question. I suppose the short answer was one day in my garage, I'd started a website and I was collecting maps and dealing for my garage as a hobbyist, and a big order came in and I was hooked. I already was obsessed with collecting maps, and I realized there was a chance of making it a business, and that was 25 years ago.
By the way, I think I called you a collector. You're a dealer.
Correct.
You're a map dealer.
Well,
okay.
I was a collector first for a few years.
Okay. Do you remember the first map? The very first map that you ever got?
Absolutely.
All right, what was it?
It was a map of San Diego Bay. I paid $65 for it, and I negotiated for a week and a half by fax machine for a better price.
Well, talking about history, fax machines, what's that? I haven't used one in a long time. When did you decide, though, that maps would be the full-time thing for you? you know, that, all right, I'm ready to leave everything I've got. I want to put my whole life into this.
Well, I loved your intro because you described my childhood experience crossing the country with a map in my lap at an age where I couldn't even see over the dashboard as we did cross-country trips. So maps were definitely in my DNA. I think it was when I realized that as a lawyer, my life trajectory was going to be very different than if I was selling maps. I had a chance to take a little shop next to my kid's school. It was already had a pretty successful hobby website, and it was just compelling. It, you know, you make your own day, you do your own thing, you're a history detective every day. And while you know what you do for a living, you never know where it's going to take you on any one occasion.
I want to know, yeah, where has this, this venture for you taken you? I mean, what are some of the interesting places and people that you've talked to as you've tried to find these rare, amazing maps?
Wow, a great question. You know, I think now my entire vacation schedule is actually around the interesting people we've met and the collections we go to visit. So recently we were in Turkey on Akyaka Bay with one of the biggest collectors in Turkey, you know, spending a week at one of his places and looking at his collection in Turkey. The National Library of Australia is having an event in a few weeks that I'm supposed to fly out to see. And the most important thing about it is there's exciting places to go, but there are map enthusiasts everywhere, and it's an amazing community of people, you know, interesting, dynamic, well-traveled, very engaging people who are thrilled to meet each other.
I wonder what that world is like. I mean, you're looking for these rare maps, these very old historic maps. What is that world like? Who are these people that you're dealing with and you're trying to buy, or, you know, you're finagling to get that right price? You want something that's really special. I mean, take me there.
You know, it could be anything from an invitation to look at a castle collection, which has happened on more than one occasion, to eBay or grandma's attic. And you meet a very, very wide variety of folks, some very, you know, very erudite and well-traveled, and, you know, people whose names you would recognize who've built up amazing collections, you know, in some cases, you know, ambassadors and congressmen and whatnot. But just as often, these remarkable people who've lived these remarkable lives that you've never heard of before, you know, college professors, heirs to mining fortunes, you know, or just a teacher who some similar person who's inherited a collection or tripped up in grandma's attic. One of my favorite stories is that one of the dealers who will be there 30 years ago, his father was invited into his childhood music teacher's house to come look at a chest of maps that had been found in the attic. And it turned out to be the original Lewis and Clark manuscript maps.
Oh, did you see these?
No, they're with they're now, I believe, with Yale or the Library of Congress. I think it's Yale.
All right, but take me to a moment when you saw a map that you couldn't even believe was in front of you.
I think probably the most exciting discovery was I bought a collection in Paris, and we knew more or less what it was, but it just didn't seem... It seemed too good to be true. And then when it arrived, the prize item was what's referred to now as the Comanche pictograph map. And it's the only known example of a Comanche Indian in the 18th century drawing a map by hand, which is a pictograph map describing a battle that they'd fought with the Apaches in New Mexico around 1787.
All right. What kind of maps do you have that you're going to be displaying in this year's fair?
I like to think I've got something for just about everyone. We'll have maps that show the world before Columbus. We'll have maps that show the early history of discovery. We'll have a lot of local history interest. And I think the map that's probably the most interesting, which I own a piece of, but which will actually be in a different booth, is the first map to depict any portion of Miami.
All right, let's talk about that map, because that's the one that I was hyping up here before the program. But this was a hand-drawn map of a part of Miami, and we don't know who drew it. It was a soldier of some sort. But first, describe what that looks like.
So if you could imagine a sheet of paper, ruled paper 8.5 by 11, turned on its side, this is a hand-drawn pencil sketch showing the mouth of the Miami River where it enters Key Biscayne. And on the north shore, there's a couple of tents and then some permanent structures, one of which is the oldest surviving building in Miami, which I believe has been moved to Loomis Park. It was drawn in 1849 between the Second and Third Seminole Wars at a time when Fort Dallas was occupied for about 15 months.
How do you prove the authenticity of a map like this?
One of the interesting things about being a dealer is sometimes you work your ass off to prove what something is, and sometimes it's just very obvious. This one has names and places and information that could only have been done by an extraordinary forger or by somebody who was actually there. And because the map was acquired as part of a collection of correspondence that was coming from a soldier who'd been there, it was very clearly authentic. And the price we were fortunate enough to pay for it 10 years ago when we first acquired it was modest enough that certainly if it was an attempt to forge, they did a very, very poor job of marketing.
You know what I'm curious about? When you look at a map like that, what is the value of something like that?
We're asking $85,000 for it.
Who's setting those prices?
It's a great question. There isn't a straightforward answer. Enough maps change hands in that price range that you can fairly estimate what it should sell for. I think the final arbiter of value on this one was that we had a very, very similar map of Honolulu from about the same time period with some handwritten annotations that had sold for roughly the same price quite quickly. So we felt comfortable with the $85,000 asking price.
Barry, is there a map that you know about or that you've heard of that you would love to at least see that, or you want to get your hands on? Is there that one map that's just, it's eluding you, but you got to get out there and you got to find it?
I always say a question like that is asking me to choose among my children because there's so many choices.
Okay. Well, let's pick one. Just one as an example. And I'm wondering if it's been a long journey trying to even get to it.
Wow. There are some wonderful and quite possibly mythical maps which were drawn by explorers who reportedly discovered either America or the Arctic before Columbus, which live in collector legend. And we know that they're half truth, half fiction. And, you know, it's always a great dream to find one of those maps. And as recently as a few years ago, a 13th century sea chart hand-drawn on vellum was found used as a binding for an 18th century map. So they're hiding out there. We know there's great discoveries to be found out there. It's just a matter of being patient and being open-minded enough to recognize what they are.
You know what, Ed, just real briefly in the short time that I have is, you know, again, anyone who hasn't been to this fair, I can tell you, it is just, again, these are beautiful, I consider works of art, but it's a lot of wonderful history. Anybody who's never gone, I mean, what do you tell them about the experience they're going to have?
If you love maps, it's Mecca. If you've never considered maps as either objects of art or history, there's going to be something there for you. The material is going to range from mid-century modern pictorial maps that show Miami, you know, in the 1950s to 15th century pre-Columbian material. So quite literally, there's something to be fascinated by.
A little bit of everything, as you just said. Barry Lawrence Rudderman, again, he is one of the dealers who is going to be at the Miami International Map Fair, and it's being held, by the way, at the Miami History Museum this weekend. We'll have more information on our website. A lot of beautiful, rare, and unique maps on display. Barry, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that's the program for today. By the way, remember, you can always find us on iTunes. Just look up WLRN Sundial. Coming up next week, you know what? There's a big launch coming up at Cape Canaveral, the new SpaceX, the big giant rocket. We're going to talk to Florida Spaceman about that. And also, more on the Florida Constitution Commission. They have a big event coming up here in South Florida. That's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you next week.